ओम्फर्ताय प्रतिबोधिताम् पटपथा नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतिताम् पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीम् भगवतीम् अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वैषिणी।
We'll work on verse 18, chapter 4.
Karmanya karma yav pashet. Karmanya karma yav pashet. Akarmani cha karma yaha. Akarmani cha karma yaha. Sabuddhiman manusheshu. Sabuddhiman manusheshu. Sayukta kritsna karma krit. Siddha Krishna Karma Krit.
Karmani, a karma, from karman, right? Karma, the nominative. Karmani, a karma, yaha, pashet, a karmani, jakarma, yaha. Saha, buddhiman, manusheshu, saha, yuktaha, Kritsna karma krit.
Karmani, locative singular, karmani, in karma, a karma, a karma, yaha pashet, the one who sees a karma in karma, the one who sees a karma, we'll see exactly what this means, but a karma for now, in action, karmani, a karma, yaha, pashet, the one who sees a karma in karma, and karmani, a karmani cha, karma, yaha, and in a karma, from karman, karmani is locative singular, a karmani, and in a karma cha, karma, and the one who sees karma in a karma. So the one who sees in karma, a karma, and who sees in a karma, karma, that one, Saha buddhiman. That person has knowledge. Buddhi means they. You don't want to say they have an intellect. Everybody has an intellect. So that person has this knowledge. That person is wise in reference to this. Saha buddhiman. That person is wise. Manusheshu, among all beings, among all the human beings, it is that person who sees that. That person among the people. That person is a buddhiman. He is yuktaha. He has nishta. Means he has, yuktaha means he has, you can say yoga, but yoga means is free from, as that vi-yoga, in fact, yoga is vi-yoga, means he has self-knowledge, he has nishta in himself, he's yuktaha. And he is kritsna karmakrit. Kritsna karmakrit is a word that's used for the Jivanmukta. And it means the one who has done everything. For that person, everything to be done has been done. Kritsna means whole. Everything has been done. Kritsna karmakrit. All karmas, all the karmas have been done. Everything you think you need to do, everything you think you need to accomplish, all of those things are done. The whole, all of the karma, it's over, it's finished, it's been done. Kritsna karmakrit. So that's a name that's used for a jnani. A jnani is the person who's done all that needs to be done. All there is to be done, that's finished. So this is a big verse. It's this verse kind of like a little capsulization of the whole vision. Who is a buddhiman? Who is one that has this knowledge? Well, it's a person who sees karma in akarma and akarma in karma. So now that has to be unpacked. In this section, the previous verse, Krishna was saying, I want to Arjuna, I need to teach you clearly what is the nature of karma and akarma. What is karma? What is akarma? And so that's been the subject matter, and now he's going to teach it in terms of what it really is. Now, let's take karma here just to mean any activity, action, any type of action. Kriya is the root, comes from the root kriya, to do, right? So kriya, to do, karma, that means it's a derivative of this verbal root kriya, to do, to make. And so karma means action, you know, any type of action, any type of doing, karma. So the one who sees akarma, the one who sees karma in akarma, first of all, there is no such thing as akarma in the world. For instance, you can think of akarma. Swamiji uses the example. This would be an example of karma and akarma in my relative sense. And taking a walk, I'm walking. That's a karma. I'm doing the karma. I'm walking. I stop walking. I'm standing still. I'm not walking. So now that I've stopped this activity of walking, that was a karma. Now that not walking is a karma. Now I'm not walking. Right? But the problem is now even though I'm not walking, I'm standing. And that's another karma. Right? So it takes action to do and action not to do. And so in the creation, there's no such thing as karma and akarma in a real sense of the term. In fact, any type of not doing is just a type of not doing. That is the doing. Sitting still is the act of sitting still. Not walking is the act of not walking, of standing still. Not breathing is the act of holding your breath. See what I mean? So you can't find in the whole creation there is nothing going on except karma. And so you have to look at this creation. So when you think of this duality, karma and akarma, you can't have the akarma be something that is taking place in the creation. There is no such thing as akarma in the creation. There's only action in one form or another. Even the action of stillness, right? The action of quietude, and the action of activity, all is a different form of action. And so now, say if I see, now just on this very simple level, says, he who sees in the akarma, in karma. Okay? So in one sense, it's that I don't see any akarma. I only see karma. To the one who sees in karma, the one who sees karma in akarma, I don't see anything but karma in the sense of the world. Now, in reference to my relationship to the world as a jiva, as an individual, I am the karta. I am the doer. Right? As a jiva, I am the doer and I'm the enjoyer. Now, this is exactly now we're funneling into exactly what the problem is, why we can't get out of karma. As long as I am the karta, the doer, the doer is performing the act of standing or of walking, of breathing, of not breathing, of singing, of not singing, of talking, of not talking. The karta is there as the one who undertakes and identifies with the activity. Right? And so the karta, in fact, is the one who is going to be the problem. The karta here is going to be the problem, and also going to be the solution. Okay? So as long as the karta is here, the karma is here. Okay? Because there's somebody identified as I'm a doer. So think of it like this. In this creation, from everything that we perceive through our sense organs, to the physical body, to the five sense organs, to all of the activity in the mind, to all of the thoughts, actually, every aspect of our experience in total, all of that is karma. There's no escape from it. And so, in order for me to find a karma, I can't find it in the creation. Because it doesn't exist. A karma doesn't exist in the creation. And so, how can I see a karma in this creation? Where is it going to reside? If I take this one level, I see akarma in karma, then I can just be looking at, I see karma in akarma. If I see karma in akarma, I get these confused. If I see karma, if I see action in inaction, that's true. I'm just seeing everything as karma. I recognize that. I see everything as karma. Whether it be karma or a karma, I see it as karma. I recognize the whole creation is nothing but karma. Every single thing about my experience is karma. And I see my relationship to it as the karta, as the doer. There's the action, and I'm the doer of the action. And being the doer of the action, I am also the bhokta. So I have these two terms that come up for the jiva. Karta, bhokta. The one who does the action, the one who enjoys the results of the action. So this is like the core of the jiva. The real core of the jiva is the ahankara. The ahankara is the I am, the doer. The ahankara is this. I am what? I am the karta, I am the bhokta. I am the one who does the actions, and I am the one who enjoys the results of the actions. And that's my reality as a jiva. That's not the buddhiman. The one who has knowledge doesn't see it like that. Because for the one who has knowledge, not only is the world, this physical world that I experience through my sense organs, in continual activity, physical body, karma, continual activity, sense organs, karma, continual activity, right? Mind, continual activity, thoughts, moods, emotions, ahankara itself, continual activity. Ahankara itself belongs to the buddhi. Right? What are the components of the jiva? Right? Physical body, your sense organs, your pranas, your organs of action, and also all of the thoughts in your mind that include what? All of your memories, all of the fluctuating mind, all of the thoughts and emotions that are going through the mind, the buddhi, all of your knowledge, all of your ability to control the mind, your determinative thinking, the buddhi, and what else? The ahankara. The ahankara also belongs to the creation. The ahankara belongs to the creation. If the ahankara belongs to the creation, means it's objectifiable, then what else? The karta and bhokta belong to the creation. Who is it that says, I am the doer? Right? Ahankara. That's the buddhi. I am the doer. I am the enjoyer. Who says that? Ahankara. So I am the doer, I am the enjoyer. Both of these also are part of the creation. So for the jnani, where does the jnani reside? Who is the jnani? Who's the person? Right? Because now the karta and the bhokta, right, are seen as part of the karma, actually. They're part of the karma. They're part of the activity. And they also, the karta and bhokta, are as much objects of my knowledge, right, as is the creation. So who is the person? That's the thing. Who is the person that objectifies for whom the karta and the bhokta are objectified? Who am I? That becomes the question. Am I, the conscious being, a karta? Am I, the conscious being, a doer? Does consciousness do anything? Does awareness, the being, the me, does this me perform an action? Here I am performing actions. Like if I'm grasping my hand, you can say, I am grasping my hand. If I am talking, I can say, I am talking. I am performing the act of talking. True. I'm talking, I'm grasping, I'm moving my hands. That is true. Now, but what do I mean by the I? If I say, I am talking, who is talking? Well, my vocal cords are talking, my physical body is talking, my mind is participating in the talking, my thoughts are participating in the talking. And the conscious being identified from the standpoint of the mind and the body and the sense organs are participating in the talking. But is consciousness talking? Am I talking? So that's what we have when we say viveka, this discrimination, this discriminative analysis, you know, is so, in a way, it's not subtle at all. Once you see it, it's not subtle. Once you see it, it's actually obvious. But in order to see, what do I have to see is that now that I'm sitting here talking, and you're sitting here listening, and, you know, seated, feeling your physical body seated, and in the act of listening, there is somebody who's not listening. Through your ears, you're listening. Your mind, through the sense organ ears, you're listening. And from the listening, your mind is forming a thought modification of, you know, of the content of the talk that's coming in, that's forming vrittis in your mind, which are giving you knowledge, whatever it may be. And that knowledge is known to you. So this activity is all taking place. This is all karma pala. It's karma and pala. All of it's taking place. But now, in the midst of it, in the midst of this, all of this that's taking place, there is me. And what am I doing? What is your own presence, the conscious being that you are, what is it doing in the midst of all of this activity? And all of this talking and listening and sitting. So can you recognize in the midst of all of the activity and input that's taking place at this time, the one who is the non-participant, the one who is just the simple, silent presence of myself that isn't going through any modification at all, that is simply abiding, that one is akarma. That one is me. I am the akarma. For me, there is no karma. Nor is there any bhokta. I'm also not an enjoyer in this sense. I am enjoying myself as myself. Not in the form of an action, but in the form of my own being. That self-evident being. That's the kind of the my own non-dual presence, the self-evident being just of awareness itself. That is its own experience. And so if we want to say there's any enjoyment there, it's just the self-evident nature of consciousness itself, the Sat-Chit-Ananda, which is my own being. So that being simply abides. I am simply abiding. I'm not doing anything at all. So there's no becoming happy or becoming sad or becoming agitated or there is no gaining knowledge. I'm not gaining knowledge. Atma is not gaining knowledge. My mind is gaining knowledge. My mind is gaining understanding. But what about me, the one who is silently abiding? Okay, so now, this one, the akarta nature of it, of myself, is what maybe we don't highlight so much. For instance, when we're sitting in contemplation. You're sitting in contemplation, you take it for granted, you might not highlight it. When you're sitting in contemplation, just notice what you're doing. The karma, your experience of the world, all of the activity, all of the karma, you are very consciously slowing it down to the point of not having to notice it. Like, for instance, we're sitting quietly and we try to get ourselves into a comfortable position. Well, you can just relax your body so that it's not noticeable. The body's there, but you relax it, it's not calling your attention. So the mind is, in a way, pulling itself away from that type of content. Your eyes are closed, so you're pulling away from worldly content. You're relaxing your body, you're pulling it away from physical content. You know, you're giving your mind some time to relax so that it can also become spacious, so that you can pull away from that type of distraction and content. where do you end up? When you silence the world, when you silence all of the karma, you're silencing the karma, right? So that you don't have to notice it. So that your own swarupa, your own being, becomes more predominant, right? Becomes more predominant in the field of experience that you've created for yourself. What is that being? Is it a karta? Is your consciousness, yourself, just the abiding me? Is it a karta? Does it do anything? Can it do anything? Is doing something even relevant? Doing or non-doing is absolutely has no relevance. I never consider myself as a doer. When you get to just your own sitting, just with your own being, it has nothing to do with being a doer. It has just something to do with you, with being, simply being. That's the akarma. So now, here with all of this talking going on, the presence of your own physical body, whatever your mind is doing, whatever your senses are doing, is the akarma yourself. You recognize yourself in the midst of all of this. Are you, is the aparokshatvam, the self-evident nature of you, the one who is the akarta, really, where there is no karma at all? Does the antakarana, does the mind, is the mind awake to the self-evident abiding of me? And that self-evident abiding of me, that non-doer, it is always, always exactly the same. For the mind, is my own presence dominant? Is the akarma dominant? Predominant? Amidst all of the activity of the mind and the ahankara, the sense organs, physical body? Because if it is, then I have to start understanding satyam mitya. This is the satyam mitya, the understanding of mitya. It's like the dagda bija, the burnt seed. My mind is thinking, so I can say, I am thinking, and as I am saying, I am thinking, the presence of me, who is not thinking at all, is abiding. I say, I am thinking, that's mitya. Right? I say, I am thinking, and as I'm saying, I am thinking, the me is absolutely present. The me that is not doing any karma whatsoever is the absolute presence in the midst of the one who is thinking. The me that is not thinking, seeing, is absolutely present to the one who is seeing. You see what I'm saying? I am not seeing, I am seeing. I am not thinking, I am thinking. I am not moving my hands, I am moving my hands. One is satyam, one is mitya. And both are happening in exactly the same time, exactly the same place. This becomes really, this is why, again, if you can be with your own mind, you can say, you know, like if you have an imagination, you can say, I am still, I am absolutely still and present. Right? I'm the one who is absolutely still and present and pervasive to the imagination, to the thought. Like if I ask you to think of a meadow, you think of a meadow, you're aware of your own presence, and you're aware of the meadow. You think of yourself walking along in the meadow, you're aware of your own presence, which is still, the awareness, which is substrate, right, to the thought. And at the same time, you are aware of yourself walking through. So you can say, I am walking through the meadow, and I am not walking through the meadow. You can say, I am just pure being, and I am the meadow. Right? You can say both. I am pure being, and I am the meadow. But one is satyam, and one is mitya. What is satyam? What is satyam when you say, you know, we're using meadow as an imagination. What is satyam is the one that doesn't ever change. Satyam is the very being of every experience. What is true is that which never modifies, never changes at all. It is real. It is real being itself. It doesn't come into being. It doesn't go out of being. It is the one that is there, the truth, and pervasive to every experience that I have. That is the Satyam. What is the Mithya? The Mithya is what totally enjoys the Satyam, which is not away from it in any way, right? But which is continually coming and going. Right? It's not away from it. So Mithya doesn't have any being of its own. That's why we say, that's why we like to use your mind just to really understand how Mithya is. The real example that we use in the world besides the mind and dream for Mithya is the rope snake. Right? The rope snake versus the clay pot. You know, when we use the example of the clay pot, we use the clay pot to show that the Satyam is the material cause of the Mithya, of all names and forms in this creation. Say this: if we say this creation is non-dual, it's one without a second. How can we say that? What do we mean when all we experience is duality? We use the clay pot for this. We mean that the truth, which is the awareful being, the existence itself, is all that is here. Like in the clay pot, the only thing that is there is clay. The only thing that is here is consciousness. To the same degree that the only thing in the clay pot is clay, the only thing that is here is consciousness. So that's showing Advaita. But then we have to show the mityatva of all of this duality that we experience. Because here I am as a conscious being, sitting in the midst, being in the midst of this creation of continual karma. This creation that I'm sitting in, that includes the body, the mind, the sense organs, is in constant flux. Right? Everything about it is changing, including my body, every thought that I have, every perception that I have, even the I thought, I am doing this, I am doing that. It's nothing but a vritti. All of these perceptions, including the perceptions of the world, say just the perception of the room, all of it is in continual flux and has me for its reality. But I am not in continual flux. This is in continual flux. How can this be all in continual flux and me be a karma if I'm its very being? That's why we have to bring in the rope snake to show exactly the type of mithya we're talking about. Because if we think of the rope snake, the snake has no substance apart from the rope. There is really only a rope there. The rope is the truth, the being of the snake. Okay? Now, that is much more true to the relationship you have with your own mind. Okay? Just take the mind. If you have a thought in your mind, that's a rope-snake relationship. Right? Because the thought comes from me, is totally dependent on me and goes back into me. The thought has no being, has no, obviously no substance. Nothing about it has no substance, has any substance apart from me. But I am not in any way changed by it. That's when there's a technical term for this, it's called vivarta upadana karanam. It means that the material cause, the upadana karanam, this word for material cause, here is Brahman, as the self, doesn't go through any type of modification to become the creation. I am the material cause, the very substance of any thought, but I don't go through any type of becoming or change to become that thought. I always remain the same. And so now, if I point that out to you in reference to a thought, I ask you, well, have a thought of a meadow, the metal comes from you, sustained by you. If you pull, if you retrieve the thought, it goes into unmanifest condition. You can very well see that your being is the truth of the thought, and at the same time doesn't go into a process of becoming. The me doesn't become. The me doesn't do. It's easy to see in terms of a thought. It's easy to see in terms of a dream if we look in hindsight. That's good for satya mitya. The dream comes from me, it's so real while it's there. This whole manifestation of duality. And it comes, stays for a while, and it goes. Nothing happens to me, but I am the satyam. I am the akarma. I am what is akarma. The manifestation is karma. Everything in it is karma, in the manifestation, because of all continual activity. But for me, for a jiva, a jiva doesn't appreciate the akarma. Because for the jiva, the identification is only with the body, mind, sense organs, ahankara. So the self-identification stops at the ahankara. Means I am. I am a conscious being who is a karta bhokta, doer and enjoyer. And so this anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition, is totally there. Right? Totally there for the jiva. For the jnani, that anyonya, that ajnana, that ignorance that causes this mutual superimposition, that isn't there. And so what happens is this karta bhokta jiva becomes part of the mitya, becomes part of the snake. I am the rope. So my ropeness, my beingness, is never in question, in spite of, as long as this body, mind, sense organs, all of the thoughts and moods and emotions and ahankara, as long as the jiva upadhi is here, in spite, as I am not doing anything, I am doing. As I am not thinking, I am thinking. As I am not hearing, I am hearing. As I am not talking, I am talking. Both are absolutely true, but one is satyam, one is mitya. And the reason you can say, I'm talking, I'm not talking, it's because you recognize yourself and you recognize the activity of the upadhi at the same time. Both are self-evident. Self-evident in the sense that my being is self-evident, and as long as the antikarana is there, it is also shining, right? The antikarana is sattva. So whenever the mind is there, whenever the mind is up, it is known. If the ahankara is up, if the mind is up, the ahankara is there, it is known. Perception is there, it is known. Activity is there, it is known. So that is always happening, but it's happening mitya. It's what we call dugdha bija. Dugdha bija means it's a burnt seed. It's not causing any problem. It's being totally experienced, but it's not causing a problem. It doesn't interfere with me. It doesn't cover me. It doesn't cover me, and both are happening simultaneously. See, that's the thing. We can think that ajnanam, sometimes we view ajnanam, ignorance, as though it's covering me. It's not like there's a bag over me, like there's some sort of a physical cover. There is no physical cover. Like we can think, like there's the atma, and then there's a wall of ignorance, and then there's the mind and sense organs and the, you know, the experience.
Of course.
And what I have to do is somehow remove the wall of ignorance so that the self experience can come. It isn't that. It isn't that. Yourself, the self me, the self experience that you are, by experience I mean self evident, the aparokshatvam of the conscious being that you are, is self-evident, totally, 100%, at all times, whether you have jnanam, ignorance, whether you have ajnanam or jnanam. If you have ignorance or you have knowledge, it is not a comment at all on the self-evident nature of you. The jnanam and the ajnanam has only to do with the extra baggage that you have loaded on to the me, to your self-experience. The anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition of taking the self-experienced me to be conflated with, superimposed on, the experience, the thoughts in the mind, the emotions, the ahankara, to be superimposed on the meadow, and you in the meadow. It's superimposed on what is drishya, superimposed on the mitya, on the things that are coming and going in your experience. It's not that you are covered, it's that because of ajnanam, you take your full, whole, complete self to be one with these things that you're experiencing. And so when jnanam, when knowledge takes place, what happens is that you're recognized that yourself is, has been, and always has been, and always will be, and is at this time, absolutely, totally, whole, and complete, and not dependent on the mitya, the things that are, the experiences that are coming and going. That you, in fact, are a karma. You are not doing anything. You are absolutely the content of the totality of your experience, but you're absolutely free and absolutely silent and absolutely present, absolutely whole, absolutely complete. There's nothing to be done. And that self is aparoksha. Aparoksha means you are self-evident amidst all of the experience of doing. All of the experience, everything that you experience within the mitya, all of the doing, all of the karmas, all of the actions of the body, all of the actions of the mind, all of the actions of the sense organs, all of the actions of the world, all of the activity that's taking place, all of it, including your sense perception and every vritti in your mind, even the ahankara. Vritti means every thought modification in your mind, even the I thought. All of that is taking place in you who are a karma. So here it says, the karmani akarma yaha pashet. He who sees akarma in karma. Okay. So amidst all of this, so take that, this part like this. Amidst all of this karma, the akarma is aparoksha to me. Amidst all of the activity, while I'm, as I'm talking, I can say I am not talking. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm making it up. Because the nature of your own swarupa is not talking. There's no movement going on. So the one who sees that on every level, you see the akarma in karma, and you see in akarma karma. You can take that two ways. You see in akarma karma means here there is no akarma. There is only karma. Like I was saying before, there's, you're walking, you've stopped. That's not a karma, that's standing. So there's no akarma here. So you see in all akarma, you see only karma. There's no such thing as akarma. That's one. The other is, again going back to the self, I am the akarma. I am akarma. And it's in me all karma takes place. So that's recognizing really me as the very substratum of all of my experience. So that's also true. The person who knows that, the aparoksha tvam of yourself, in fact, all this karma is taking place in me, and then I am also in all karma, I am the one who is there as akarma. I am the akarma in all karma, and all karma takes place in me. You can go that way too. So all of that's just highlighting the satyam mitya, the satyam mitya of your own being. And that, now, what does it mean? It means that you've recognized the stability of yourself, the changeless stability of yourself amidst all experience. And then, as we'll see as we go on, when you recognize that changeless stability of yourself in all experience, then that self really is what the mind is attached to. Because the self is whole and complete. And so that Before, that is not what stood out for the antikarana. That's not what stood out. What stood out for what stands out, I would say, for an agnani is here I am as the karta bhokta, the doer and the enjoyer, here as this body, mind, sense organs, here I am in this world. And so I am engaged in activity in this world. Because my identification is with the ahankara, right? The I notion, which is the karta and bhokta. And so that I notion is my center. And it is a conscious existent being, but this conscious existent being is in the form of my body, mind, sense organs complex. It is me. And I am making decisions and going forward as an individual within this creation. But for the jnani, the situation is different. For the jnani, that ajnanam, that ignorance that has caused this mutual superimposition, is not there anymore. And so even though the body, mind, sense organs, with your thoughts and moods and emotions and the ahankara, are all moving about in the world and doing action, doing all these karmas, I am not doing anything. That aparoksha atma has been released. It's been released from the ajnanam. Means the mind no longer takes this, the mind has been released from the ignorance that has caused it, this red hot iron ball syndrome, where it only knows to take itself. It's never even thought about it. It has only taken me to be itself. That's it. And that's how life has proceeded. Once that mind has knowledge, it goes on doing this and that and the other thing, but it itself has recognized that it is totally dependent upon me for its being, like the pot is totally dependent on the clay for its being. That mind is totally dependent upon me. I am its truth. I am its being. But I am not dependent on it at all. I don't change in any way at any time. And that is a huge relief for the mind. So I am a sense, and other verses as we go through this, we'll see, I become the best friend of the mind. I am the mind's best friend. Because I am the stable being which the mind can always count on. I am always present, relentlessly present, and nobody can do anything about it. And the invariable nature of my presence is something that the mind gives, the freedom for the mind, you know. My freedom, the freedom of my being, is the freedom for the mind. The moksha for the mind is the recognition that I am free. Moksha for the mind is not that the mind is free. The mind is mitya. And if the mind is mitya, it's free in that sense. It's mitya. Because the truth of it is free. Right? The mind realizes I am mitya and that the me, the truth, the atma, is free, is stable. The mind becomes free because its truth is free. So it's a beautiful freedom like this. And so now, Krishna says, the buddhiman among all people is the one who recognizes this. Also, in the previous verse, Krishna says, it's that person who knows me. When Krishna is talking about himself as Ishwar, as an avatar, the one who's, just a few verses back, he talked, I as Ishwar, I created this whole creation. This whole creation has come from me, sustained by me, and resolves into me. I am the karta. I am the creator of this whole creation. And I do nothing. Not doing anything. Being beginningless, birthless, free from all action. I am the karta of all of this. The one who understands that person is free, that person knows me. Is that person, then he says, that person in fact is me. And now he says, again, talking what he's just had earlier said about himself as Ishwara. Now he says to Arjuna, you know, the one who sees akarma in karma and sees karma in akarma, that person among all beings, that person is a buddhiman. That is that person that knows. That person has self-knowledge. Satyamitya. That person knows. And then he says, and that person is a Krishna karma krit. For that person, there's nothing. Everything has been done. Krit means he is done. Krishna means everything karma. All karmas he's done. It's over. There's nothing, with the idea of Krishna karma krit, there's nothing else to be achieved. Right? There's certainly nothing to be achieved by karma. What will karma do for you? You already are whole, and you're all a karma by nature. That is your swarupa, a karma. So you're already a karta, you're a bhokta. So what will you gain by doing karma? Really, what will you gain? And so for that reason, when that starts being really understood, karma yoga for the person, because it takes a while to really understand this, to really assimilate the truth of it. And so all of this karma yoga then becomes very, very meaningful. Because this all being mithya, there really is nothing to gain. There's nothing for you to gain in terms of improving yourself or becoming more whole or more full. In the very source of ananda, you are the akarma, the atma. That is the very source of ananda. What is there for you to gain? So what karmas are there for you to do? There is nothing for you to do. And so then what do you do? You know, there's nothing for you to do to become whole. So what is there for you to do? What is there for you to do, really, as a jiva, as part of Ishwara's creation, is your prarabdha karma. The karma, prarabdha karma means the karmas that caused you to take this birth that will unfold throughout your life until your death. Now those karmas are here, right now. This is it. So the karmas, as these karmas present themselves, because here this jiva is, which is also part of the prarabdha karma, here the sense organs are, the body is, the environment that you find yourself in, here it is. Right? And so none of it makes a difference to your being, to the Atma. The Atma is akarta. So that's not going to be affected one way or another. But here's this upadhi that really is Ishwara. The whole upadhi is really Ishwara. Right? It's part of, if you say like this, when I say the whole upadhi is part of the Lord, it's part of Ishwara. In this way, if I imagine, say, please imagine a meadow, and fill the meadow with people and animals and trees, you know, and the sun and wind, and fill the meadow up with all living creatures. And now, what if I say, all of those living creatures are part of me alone, are part of the Lord of the meadow. They're all just the meadow. They're all just Ishwara. So if you're the Ishwara of the meadow, you've imagined the meadow, the meadow has come from you, and all of the creatures, everything is in the meadow. They're all Ishwara. Every single thing in the meadow is Ishwara, right? There's not one thing that isn't. Everything is equally Ishwara. There's one big story there. That is Ishwara. Everything in it is Ishwara. All the laws are Ishwara. Absolutely everything that is going on there is Ishwara. So if I say, you know, this is after all, this is only Ishwara, the whole thing, you know, is that true or not true? Well, it depends. If you're an Ajnani, you say, who is Ishwara? Well, whatever Ishwara is, I'm here within it. But actually, every single thing about the jiva is part and parcel of Ishwara, just like every part of the meadow imagination is part and parcel of the meadow. So this whole thing is Ishwara. So then now, you say, well, okay, this is all Ishwara, then what am I supposed to do? Well, in terms of doing, all of the doership in any sense is mithya. So what should I be doing? Well, you should just be doing what is exactly here in front of you to do. That's why Swamiji says, I just do
You know, I do what is here to do. It's very simple. I do what is here to do. How can life be that simple? When I say I do what is here to do, how can it all be that simple? It is that, in fact, it is that it is that simple for a person who is whole and complete. Why am I whole and complete? Because I'm a karta, a bhokta. There's nothing that can do to change me, and that swarupa, my own nature, by nature is whole and complete. So we don't meditate, you know, meditate and shut everything down and then go, oh, how disappointing. You do only when you can't quieten yourself, you know. Your being is the most beloved. Your presence is the most dear to you, the most beloved. You know, let all the other things go. Just let me be here. Your own swarupa is the most beloved. And so what happens when the mind stops? You know, trying to find yourself in the mitya. What happens when it's not trying to do that anymore? You know, then it simply, say from a karma yoga, as you start to really get this knowledge, I think one of the most profound, one of the most wonderful practices is the practice of bringing your mind back to where you actually are right now. What you actually have right now. What is actually here right now. This is it. You know? Bringing it back to the present, which is Ishvara. And just being present to that. It's a very beautiful meditation, because you'll find that for the Ajnani, until your mind settles down, we spend so much time out here and into the future. We live in a web of worry, a web of possibility. You know, and when you live in a web of possibility, because we're so intelligent, the mind is very intelligent, it doesn't just see one side of the possibility. It sees, you know, it sees the spectrum of what could happen in any given possibility. You know? And you don't usually, when your mind is out there imagining the possibility, usually have a preference. You would like it to go this way and not this way. You would like to feel this way and not this way. But unfortunately, we see all of the possibility. And that's where so much concern comes. Yeah. That's why it's so helpful to just remember to bring yourself back to the reality. You know, the reality is such a mitya reality, really. But here I am, my being is not going anywhere. It is not changed. Yeah. My mind can never get away from myself. And this is Ishvara's moment. And the next moment is Ishvara's moment. And the next moment is Ishvara's moment. And this is what I'm called to do in this particular moment. And in the next moment, and the next moment. And every moment is busy. Do you know? It's not like there's a moment that is not full. I mean, that's what I mean. It's not like there's a moment that's not full. Yourself is full, and Ishvara is full. So you are fully present in the moment. See what I'm saying? It's just a matter of being there. It simplifies things so much, because you're not worried. It takes away so much worry. So that's why he says, that's Kritsna Karmakrit is not a little thing. You know, the one who says, I've done everything that I need to do, and so now what should I do? I've done everything. So whatever is here, I've done what needs to be done. There's nothing more to do. So let me do well what is here. And you have to, I mean, Swamiji is such a wonderful example of this, because he does so much. Whatever is here, he just does it. He just does it. He just does it. He just does it. All the while, he's not doing anything. He doesn't have any sense that he's doing anything either. You know? And that's the truth for ourselves, too. So, if you have... Does everybody have the hand, Swamiji's handout? You have it. And that you should read. He wrote maybe 10 pages.
Yeah, it's really long.
10, 12 pages on. He really went into this. And Shankara has a long bhasha on this, too. I brought in a lot of the points, but it's really worth, you know, spending some time, because this verse is so important. And it'll be a theme all the way through also. The one who sees the karma and akarma, and akarma and akarma. This won't be the first verse. It goes all the way through the Gita. It's really beautiful. See. So let's stop there and just take a moment. Purnamadat, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Hari Om.
This karma,
mm-hmm.
It's easy for me to see, or somewhat easy, to see akarma and karma. And what's the other part do we have to see?
Well, if you say akarma and karma,
yeah,
then karma and akarma.
Why is that more fun?
You know, there's a lot of karma in akarma.
No, akarma in karma. That's okay.
Because if I say akarma in karma, I see myself in all of this karma as akarma.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. That's what it is. In all of the karma, in all of the actions, in all of the doership and the enjoyership, and in all of the activity, all of the karma, I see myself as akarma. So, that's what I was trying to circle around with this satya mitya, that both are happening at the same time. That's why they say that the karma becomes like a burnt seed. In other words, it doesn't bear any fruit because it's mitya. It can't doesn't get you into trouble because of the mityatva. But it doesn't mean that it's not completely happening. You know, that's why that verse that comes later, you know, not seeing, I see, not doing, I do, not hearing, I hear, like that. Some people think, you know, some of you will make fun of this, will think, oh, you know, we think that for the wise man, we think he's seeing and talking and blinking and all of these things, but he really isn't. It's with the idea that You know, you seem like you're seeing, but you're not. But actually, what you have to understand is that the seeing is taking place. I am seeing, and I'm not seeing. I'm seeing, you know, from the standpoint of all of the upadhi, the body, the mind, the sense organs, and all of this activity is taking place. So whether I'm jnani or ajnani, whether I have knowledge or ignorance, it's all taking place the same. But for the jnani, you recognize the stability, the akarma, the changelessness of yourself also at the same time. Both are there. And it's never, once you recognize yourself, you recognize you're always there in exactly the same way. And there's nothing you can ever do to hurt that, to change it. And then you keep noticing, and then you say, finally your mind just goes, yeah, that's true. There's nothing I can do. Building them.
Living in the flow of grace.
Living in the flow of grace, yeah, from the standpoint of the mind. Yeah, where you...
Living where?
In the flow of grace. It's just poetic. It's yeah.
Go with the flow?
No.
If you want to.
So, if you say it's a simultaneous experience, the problem I have with that is, let's say I'm picking up this pen, right? The moment I'm picking up this pen, there's a certain kind of, as you were saying, there's a certain kind of intention, there's a decision that came in place, there was a thought process, there's a certain identification with this pen that now I'm writing with a pen, and the story goes on and on, right? So, for me to simultaneously experience that I'm not taking the pen,
okay, go ahead.
Because the idea, I mean, I understand...
You're thinking of it like a thought. Okay. That's why. Okay. It's not you're supposed to...
Okay.
I'm picking up the pen. I'm not picking up the pen. It's not a thought. It's not a thought. It's a reality.
Right, I'm just saying, in your experience, that's kind of what I'm going after, actually. The experience now, for me not to pick... While I'm picking up the pen, simultaneously, not be identified with a doership of picking up the pen, that seems like I like to experience that actually.
Well, wait.
I'm not quite sure.
Because you might be complicating it.
Okay.
You're picking up the pen. You know very well you're picking up the pen to write or do whatever you're going to do. All of that activity, all of the thought that goes along with it, all of that's taking place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You don't have to worry about that. It can be layers of thought, and then you can even be thinking at the same time about what you have to write. You know? And then worried about whether or not you're going to be able to do it. I mean, layers and layers, just all of the mitya. Okay? All of that mitya, all of that multidimensional thinking, all of that is taking place. And while all of that is taking place, I am silently abiding. And that is also taking place. And that silent abiding is self-evident. It doesn't need a thought to acknowledge it. Right?
Okay.
The mind doesn't have to say, oh, look, I'm silently abiding while all of this is taking place.
It doesn't need remembering.
It doesn't need remembering.
Yeah.
You don't need to remember yourself because yourself is self-evident. Now, let me explain it in another way that you actually take for granted. Say, forget about the recognition of the unembodied nature of yourself. So for an ajnani, say, you're just taking yourself to be the body, this person here. Just this person here. And this person here is engaged now in writing, picking up a pen and writing and doing all of this stuff. Okay? All the while that you're doing all of this, and engaged in worry about it or whatever, you are here. You don't doubt that. You are here doing all of that. Your own presence being here doing all of that is self-evident to the point that you don't even think about it. It's absolutely taken for granted. In other words, the person that's doing all of the writing and thinking that backdrop of your own presence doing it. Even though you take yourself fully to be the body, you're not thinking, I am the body who is... You don't need to think that. You don't even need to think, I am the body who is picking at the pen, who is present while I am writing.
Right. So, but now the difference... Now, for example, somebody has integrated that truth in a deeper way. How would that kind of experientially look different to me having that already as a backdrop in place too? Do you know what I mean?
Yes. What is different is that what the mind has recognized is the freedom of that presence from any type of vritti in the mind. Freedom from sorrow. Freedom from agitation. Freedom from need. It is its own changeless swarupa, which is free from death. It's free from change. It's free from loss. Nobody can take it away from you. It is the stable presence that nothing can ever touch. And that's the freedom. Because until that is recognized, that presence, which is so beloved, is this body. So it's subject to death. It is also becomes confused with the whims of the mind, the emotions of the mind.
Right? So it's the identification factor that plays a
huge role.
Yeah.
Because when yourself as you are is known, that self is free. There's nothing that can be done about it at all. And its very nature isn't clouded, it isn't covered by... So even if you have a dark emotion, with those emotions settle down in time also, because what causes the dark emotions, the painful emotions, are I need something to be different. And that's what it is. That's what it amounts to. Because even for an Ajnani, those nice moments when you're not requiring something to be different, all is fine. Your swarupa, your nature, is various abiding. Is whole and complete. It only becomes as though incomplete is when I'm looking out in the world and, oh, I need this and then I need that. Then everything, I generate a lot of pain. The mind generates a lot of pain. But once you know, the mind stops generating that pain. The whole karma yoga process is because that doership is still there, you know, because the knowledge hasn't totally completed itself. And so then we have to be with this doership in a way where I can just kind of keep remembering Ishvara. And accept, you know, that karmapala datta and all of that, prasada buddhi. We accept all. We learn how to be with Ishvara. But there comes a time when that there is really not even any karma yoga, because I'm not a karta, and the mind is resting in that, and then all of this is just Ishvara.
Radha, when you said there's the action of walking, and then you stop.
Yeah.
And that's still an action.
Yeah.
Right. So what's the difference when one brings the mind back?
See, say when I was using an action like I'm talking, I'm not talking. I'm walking, I'm not walking. That's just to show it's a play on words that people can think that there is such a thing as doing in the world and not doing. That there's such a thing as a karma in the world. Like I'm walking, I'm not walking. But we're saying there's no really anything a karma that's not action in the world. Activity is taking place in the world in one way or another. So now, what is the a karma? And that is my own presence, the conscious being, you know, that is neither a karta or a bhokta. So it's the recognition of that conscious being that is not walking when walking is taking place and not walking... It's not walking when walking is taking place, and it's not walking, it is not standing still when I'm standing still. It's the one that is free from action.
So the withdrawing of the mind is really another karma to be the witness of it, to be the awareness.
Well, when I was talking about meditation, you mean?
Right, right.
Yeah, okay. What I was trying to point out there is when we go through a process of meditation, what are we really doing is settling down all of the activity in the world, right?
Yeah.
Shutting my sense organs down to it, quietening the mind, relaxing the body, quietening the mind, right, so that I can just be with my own presence. Now, when I'm with just my own presence, that presence, the conscious being, is it doing anything? In fact, in the whole meditative process, what you're doing is bringing all of the action into a state of silence, right? So you can just appreciate the nature of yourself without that competing activity, without the competing activity, so that you can just recognize the nature of your own being. The nature of your own being is not doing anything; it just is simply being, right? Then what you want is when the mind, now say you've recognized the akarma, the simplicity of your own being. Then when the activity of the mind starts up, or when you're engaging in the world, can you recognize you're the simplicity of your own being as all of this activity is taking place? Mm. The thoughts in the mind, the ahankara, the engagement, all of that is taking place, but you, the simplicity of your own being, is still exactly as it was. In meditation, with meditation, without meditation, there's no difference. The only difference with meditation, the only thing you're doing, you're not changing your own presence. You're just quietening everything down so that your presence becomes so predominant. You know, you're more focused on just the conscious being that you are. You're silencing all of this to get it out of the way so that you can discern. But then all this comes back. You're exactly the same. Nothing has happened to you. With or without the universe, you're the same. And that's what you need to recognize, actually. That the one who's there in, you know, when you're meditating, that very same one is there when you're engaged in the world.
Well, then it starts to wind up when it starts to get agitated.
The mind gets agitated. The self doesn't get agitated.
Right. Because it's easy to see that when it's relatively peaceful.
That's right. That's what Nididhyasana is all about.
It also seems to be like, you know, there's almost latent tendencies of something like that to say, you know? It's like you get one layer and you think you got it, right? And then there's another layer that first is unconscious and then becomes purification of the mind, so to speak.
That's all mind stuff, working itself out.
Yeah.
But, you know, there comes a time when the mind is working itself out, the unconscious with layers of material, the throwing up for you to you have to deal with. But there comes a time when all of that is true. You have to work through all of this unconscious material and the reactions in your mind and the habitual things. All the while, you're akarta. You recognize that in spite of what we call this whole process of karma yoga, the whole process of antikarma, shuddhi, purity of mind, and all of that, you know, taking place. All of that is taking place in you, the one who is not doing anything.
And then it becomes more in the background, and then self is more in the foreground.
Yeah, and even I would say, yeah, what happens is, it doesn't. Well, you can know yourself as a karma, just your being. And all the while still, the mind is working out this and working out that, and that's fine. But it doesn't, you're still the same. And this stuff is having to be worked out. But you still are a karma. Right? It doesn't mean that when the stuff has to be worked out, if it has to be worked out. If there's reactions that are taking place in the mind and, you know, I'm just an assimilated way of being in the world, then all of that stuff has to work out. But all the while, you are you.
What I like about this is that it seems like it, you know, it kind of liberates you from having to have a bias towards non-action versus action, right? Because you see that you no longer have to try to check yourself to still your mind or become still or anything like that. If you actually recognize that in that's a form of action anyway, so you can't get away from action, so that's useless. And then on the other hand, it's unnecessary because there is stillness or there is non-action in the midst of action, and all action occurs within the, you know, like the field of non-action, so to speak.
That's right, and that's why through the whole Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, you know, is saying, you know, you don't take sannyasa. It's not taking the physical act of taking sannyasa to go out into the woods and think that that's going to be a karma. It's not a karma. Sannyasa actually is sarva karma sannyasa. That sarva karma sannyasa is jnanam. Because there is no sarva karma sannyasa means renunciation of all karma. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing in the world. That's not possible. Sarva karma sannyasa is jnanam, is knowledge. Mm. Right? So now, how to get that knowledge? It's not going to help you to wear orange unless your mind already has that antakarana shuddhi. You know? So then you take the sannyasa, and you don't need to work out all of these things through karma yoga. You know? So you can just take the sannyasa and be with yourself, because your mind is ready for that. But if your mind still has a lot of raga dvesha, a lot of likes and dislikes and all of that, that's why Krishna says, you stay in the field. You stay in the field of your life. So you can work through all of the things that are causing the mind to get upset. That's the perfect field. If it's something's out here causing your mind to get upset, then you need to deal. You need to deal with it until it doesn't do that to you anymore. Because what is causing that? That's nothing happening with yourself, with the Atma. Your mind doesn't need this to be happy, to be this way or that way. So there's a trigger. So now that becomes your sadhana. That's why the whole life is sadhana. And you just think, this is okay, this is what Ishvara is doing to me now.
I'm not even sure I can ask this question properly, but you know that the expression, you are the whole?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are the whole. So, when you recognize, like, you are the whole, but still, it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, see, I think I have this idea that if you recognize you are the whole, that somehow everything would be as beloved to you as your presence is to you. That all objects would seem exactly the same to you. Because if you are the whole, then they're all you. So I think that was wrong. So my question is kind of like, even if you were to recognize, yes, I am the whole, there would still be this preference for the satyam versus the mithya, in a sense, right? I mean, the mithya, it's not like the mithya turns into satyam and you love it just as much as you love your own self. Does that make sense?
You might be looking at things a little bit more actively than they actually are. Think like this. If you're taking a walk through beautiful nature, the weather is perfect, nothing wrong, no mosquitoes, nothing. Okay. Then the beauty of Ishvara is very apparent. Because your mind isn't at all asking anything to be different. Not at all. So now go come back into here more samsaric. Still, here, there are many times when your mind really isn't asking anything to be different. And it's at those times that your knowledge is just manifest. Because there's nothing in the way of it, right? So it's the raga dvesha, to the degree that raga dvesha, you know, likes and dislikes, that lack of vairagya, to the degree the lack of vairagya is there in a meaningful way, to that degree, you feel some limitation. You have to deal with the antakarana. You have to deal with your mind. When the raga, those times when the raga dvesha is not there, You're not dealing with your mind or your emotions. And so then you see things as Ishwar. It's just your knowledge. You know what I mean? It's totally available to you. When the raga dvesha is there, that's sadhana time. Okay, but now, okay, so that's one thing. You will, as a jiva, as long as you have a body and sense organs in mind, you will have raga dvesha that are benign, like dagda bija, because it doesn't matter one way or the other. You have a preference, but if you don't get your preference, you have a preference just because you're a human being and you've got your own prarabdha and, you know, your own experiences, and so you would tend to go toward this and not toward that. That'll always be there. But it's not upsetting to you. If you don't get it the way you want, then you'll take this. So there's a lot of flexibility. So then your mind has a certain, you know, abiding.
Well, what would you say about, like, themes of social justice or global warming in reference to what you just said?
Well, you know, those are problems that if you can act to in whatever way you can to be helpful. But that acting is objective. What isn't objective is when I become distraught over social injustice. There's a difference between becoming distraught over it and trying to do what I can to help it. Mm-hmm. The distraught thing is where
what's the problem with being distraught over that? I mean, it seems that,
well, if you want to be distraught, you can.
No, but it's not pleasant. But I mean,
what good does it do?
It doesn't do any good, but it seems a natural response, a healthy response even.
I would say there can be sadness would come, but then you would try to act rather than wallow.
Okay. Keep pitching.
Like with Swamiji, one thing that he was telling, the story, I wasn't there when it happened, but in India, they were driving along, and I don't remember the details, but they were driving along in a road in downtown Coimbatore, I think it was actually, and there were some cows that were being taken to the slaughterhouse. And to Swamiji, that's just totally unacceptable. You know, really would pain him to see that. And so, but what can he do? So he called the police chief that he knew, who happened to be not far away from where the cows were crossing the road. You know, they were in a truck, and there was some traffic stall or something. I don't remember the details. But what they were doing also was there was something illegal about what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was something illegal about it. And so Swamiji was able to, in this one instant, you know, he called the police chief. The police chief, was, some people were not far away, and so they were able to come and intervene. And he was very, very happy about that, you know. But what I'm saying, I mean, that would be a sorrow for him. But he doesn't like to see anything like that or any kind of suffering. But it's one thing to have the sorrow, and which is human, right? If you see the suffering of another or something, that's human to feel something, to have it pass through. But for him, and hopefully for you or for us, it passes through and you do what you can. You do what you can to help the situation. And if there's anything that you can do, but there's an objectivity. But then what is the help in wallowing if you do what you can? Yeah. It doesn't.
Oh yeah, I know it doesn't produce anything. It's just, man, I'm still struggling with that. But it seems like if everybody was distraught, then maybe there would be action over it, or you know. I feel blameworthy when I get distraught in, put it that way.
I'm not trying to make you feel blameworthy. I'm just saying what, if there's something that you see that's adharmic that needs to be done, you know, then you do what you can to help. That's it. You do what you can to help. And that's a beautiful thing. And you don't have to be distraught to see that it's adharmic. You see that it's adharmic, and then you do what you can to help. You know, and that's helpful. And it's also helpful for your own mind.
Well, like last week, you know, I said that my own peace is more important than Cheney, you know, fuming over Cheney.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
No. And in fact, that's a big thing to understand. Your own shanti should be more important than, and not more important than your self-righteous hatred for another person who is doing the wrong thing.
Especially if you can't do anything about it anyway.
Yeah.
No, but even, you know, in your personal relationships, say somebody is doing something that is hurtful. They're actually doing something that is unjust and mean and hurtful. And that's a fact. Objectively speaking, that's a fact. And they're doing it to you. You know? So now, what is the appropriate response on your part? What, how, you know? I mean, I can be, we could say, well, the appropriate, but I will be, you know, hurt and indignant and furious. Hmm. You know, I can go on and on. And, you know, twisted in pain. And a victim. Totally a victim of it, because they are doing something that is unjust and crazy and hurtful, and they're really hurting me. And so I'm sitting here self-righteously angry and hurt and hateful. Now, if I'm going to have that, if that's the way I'm going to go, then I am really going to be suffering. You know? Because what do I get out of that? What do I get from it? Suffering.
Well, it's actually interesting, you know, I had an experience like that today, you know, with Comcast, you know. And they really knocked the floor out of me, you know, and I was, at the same time, I could, it was like watching a bad movie, you know. I mean, it was like, it wasn't like I was completely sucked into it, but I felt the anger, and I even felt the appropriateness about the upsetness, and it felt all kind of, it needed to be that way, you know what I mean? It's just kind of bizarre, but something felt also right about it, because if you just, and maybe that's what Edward was also mm-hmm. pointing at a little bit, you know? This is just, like what you were saying, there's a point where you have to do something, right? So if I don't speak up and say, hey, this doesn't really work with me, you know, how you treat me, you make certain promises and you don't show up and blah, 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 you know, the rest of the story, you know, then that's kind of unacceptable.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying, is it? Why can't you say, well, do the Comcast? They're just being jerks. Okay? There. So, objectively, they're just really not doing the right thing. Okay?
Well, I can't. You see, normally I would do that, you know, but in this situation, I'm basically the one who is really screwed, because I depend on them for them turning my phone back on, right? So I have to basically pound on their door and say, come on in and fix my phone, right?
Yeah.
And if they don't do that, if I don't pound on the door, nothing is going to happen, you know? And
but
that's
listen,
the kind of thing. This is the most bizarre example, really, because in any other situation, or most most situations you have somehow a choice and you can say, okay, you know, I deal with it in a different way. But with some of these phone companies, you don't actually have a different way, you know, or you get in line with somebody else and you wait another month, and then by that time you can close your business or something, you know?
Yeah, but that's not, still not what I'm saying.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
You can say everything that you need to say and not be riled up inside. You can say you're taking an action, a forceful action. You guys have to come, or whatever it is that you say. This is absolutely necessary. This is not all right. This is not working. And you're still okay inside. Or you can say all of that, and you can be in hell inside. Right?
So you don't give up your shanti.
You don't give up your equipoise. So that's just an interesting thing to see, you know?
It is.
And say it in terms of a... But that's a little word easier to be objective. When somebody is really attacking you or hurting you, say you're having a personal relationship, and they have the power to get inside your emotional life and just twist you, you know, then how to clean that out? You know, you can feel the victim or get in it. You know, and feel retaliatory or feel justified in your hurt and how they're destroying your life and all of this kind of stuff that the psyche can do and just make it total hell for you. You know, or you can sit with that and work with it, you know, to clean that out. Because it's to your advantage. This is where the conversation started. And it's to your advantage.
For your own peace.
You know, to do the work that it takes, you know, to release yourself, to bring all of your knowledge in, to release yourself from that attachment to things being in a particular way, even when it's something you very much want. You think you want it. That's another thing. That's another important thing. You think you want it.
That you mentioned to me at one time that there's a technique or a process to accomplish that.
There are a lot of different ones. Yeah. You know. One is, it depends, and there's so many different ones, it depends on what the thing is. But one, when it's a personal relationship with somebody who's known well to you and causing a lot of pain, is to just pray for them in a way that they find their own goodness and kindness, and that you also find your own goodness and kindness. It's a way of trying, because that's what everybody wants. Doesn't matter who it is. You know, you can pray for them that they can find their own goodness and kindness, and you can find your own goodness and kindness. You know, to try to relieve the stress instead of vilifying them. You know, you try to release them from their own pain instead of vilifying them, and you release yourself from your own pain instead of, you know, thinking that you're superior. You both let everybody in the problem find their own kindness. Their own kindness and their own goodness. Instead of being, you know.
Because that's the truth of the matter. Everyone has to do that anyway. I mean, everybody's a little bit different.
Everyone has to do that, but the thing is if you don't try to release everybody involved, then they're inside of you. Swamiji used to say things like, you have to keep people outside. He's talking not about the people that are loving, supportive figures, it's the ones that are, you know, attacking or hurtful figures. They end up being inside of you. You have this relationship going on inside that's very, very painful. You need to be released from these painful relationships. And he'll say it like this, to keep them outside.
But you can't keep them outside if you don't wish them well.
It won't
happen. So that's why this learning how to wish them well and help them pray that they find their own goodness and kindness. Because if they could find their goodness and kindness, they could be kind to you. You know, and if you can find your goodness and kindness, you can be kind to them and break this this knot that's going on inside. It's, you know, like the inner relationship that's going on. You know, and that's one thing. And another is a lot of times the things that are torturing us, even about other people and their relationship with us, is that they're going to cause our life to be painful, or the way our life proceeds will be painful now because of the way these people or person or whatever is interfering in my life. They're going to make my life painful, you know. So then it's a matter of this recognizing that really, first of all, what is yours will be yours as the prarabdha unfolds. And so nobody has the power to take away or really give you anything. What is yours will be yours. And then, that being so, it's about how you're going to be with what is yours. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not going to be a matter of not having what is yours. The very prarabdha is yours. Mm-hmm. It'll take you all the way through to your death. So you will have what is yours to have. So now the question is, how can I be with what is mine? Well, what is yours will always be yours every single moment. So here's the moment. Every moment, what is yours will be yours. So the question is how to be with every moment. You know, and so here's a moment. And this moment is causing me trouble. And what about this moment is causing me trouble? So you have to kind of dissect it in a way, so that you can actually get back to the moment and get back to yourself. Because usually what is causing pain has nothing to do with the moment. It has to do with the projections that are taking place in the moment. Projections of the future agony. This situation and these people are going to be causing me. Nobody really hurts us like people. People are the ones that are the worst. The worst herders are people. And not just any people. The people we're intimately connected with. You can be very intimately connected with your enemies are as intimate to you as your friends. Those are your family. Your enemies, because enemy is a strong word. Those are your family as well as your friends. There's much your family because they are, by the very fact that you can say they're your enemy, that means you're connected. And there's all kinds of wonderful people and horrible people. It's unimaginable how bad it can be in the creation and how beautiful it can be.
So what do you
But those people are 99.9% of the most hideous, horrible things that are going on in the world are not affecting you at all. Mm-hmm. The only ones that are affecting you are the ones that are yours. All right.
Yeah.
So your enemies and your closest friends and your enemies are by the very nature close, right? But your closest friends and your enemies, those are your family. So when you pray, you know, did your parents ever teach you how to pray? You know, you just God bless Mommy and Daddy and Bill and Marianne and George. So you just go through all of them. All of your family that includes your beloved enemies. Yeah. And pray that all of them do well. Be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Oh, let's call it a day. Hi, Kiki.
Are we going to keep on this verse next time, or?
No, we're going to move on because they're all in the same theme.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm.